Welcome back to our study on the Pentateuch. Today we are doing our second session on Deuteronomy, and we're going to start in chapter 8 and go as far as we can get because there's a lot of material, and we'll just see how far we go.
Good morning.
We're going to have Jenna talk a little bit more in a minute. I just wanted to give you two quick things about chapter 8. First, specifically, you have the statement that man does not live by bread alone that you have Jesus come back to, of course. And so it led to an interesting comparison between Israel and Jesus. And if you look at them, they're both led into the wilderness. There's a 40 years, 40 days parallel. God let them be hungry, but then they're tended to. And then you have Israel, who ended up worshiping idols, and Jesus, who refused Satan's temptation. So Jesus kind of ends up being the better Israel, if you will. But I thought that was an interesting parallel because Jesus directly quotes this, man shall not live by bread alone. So I thought it was an interesting comparison. And then I want to introduce you to what's called an inclusio. It's a linguistic term, and it hasn't happened much before, but it happens here and there throughout throughout the Bible, and it's a specific literary device. And you can see it kind of focuses in on one point and then comes back out, and it uses parallel language and parallel themes all the time. So you have, for instance, at the very top, the land was sworn to your forefathers, so obey the Lord today. At the very bottom, you have God swore this to your fathers, so remember the Lord today. So very similar language. And anyway, so it goes with the swearing in, the lessons in the wilderness, the land before you is good, you will eat and be satisfied. But then the important point of the entire inclusio is do not forget the Lord. And so that's the focal point of this entire chapter, because the entire chapter is this inclusio.
Is that a Latin term?
It is a Latin term for the linguistic construct. Yeah. And you find it, you'll find it in the Psalms, and you'll find it in, you find it all over the place. So it's something that there will be another one this morning that we talk about. So they happen relatively frequently in the Bible. So,
I've never heard of it, but I could tell it was Latin.
Yes, yeah. All right, so Jenna, go ahead and take us through chapter 8 a little bit.
Okay, so I love this chapter. It's probably one of my favorite chapters. I really like it just because of how it shows that God feels about the Israelites. Stand by. I'm moving over there. So I'm in chapter Deuteronomy. I always say Deuteronomy, and that's not right. Deuteronomy, chapter 8. Once again, it starts out with a call to command. It is a call to obey all of the commands. So that you may live and increase and may enter and take possession of the land the Lord swore to your fathers. And this is the line I really love. Remember that the Lord your God led you on the entire journey these 40 years in the wilderness, so that he might humble you and test you to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commands. I just really like that because it reminds the Israelites that they were never alone the entire time that they were in the wilderness. And it also is a reminder for when they are in exile in future generations that though they are in exile, they are never alone, the entire exile. And it's a call for them in the wilderness to continue to obey the commands of the Lord. And we see this with Daniel and like lots of people, though even though they're in exile and they're surrounded by a different culture, that they still continue to obey the commands of the Lord. Another thing, too, is this book is super important. I don't know if we talked about this last week, but second only to the Psalms, Jesus quotes Deuteronomy more than any other book. And I think that is really telling. I think it means that Deuteronomy is, dare I say, this might cause some controversy, the most theologically enlightened book of the Torah? Dare I say that? What do you think, Dave? You made a face. Dare I say?
Dare away.
I dare to say. In my humble opinion, very humble opinion. And also, I really like that, that Jesus then again does quote, a man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. And I think that has been the purpose of this journey, right, is that the Israelites are to be sustained and to live by the words that come from the mouth of God. So that's basically all I have on that section.
Right.
I have to go get my Bible now. I'll be right back.
Right.
I forgot my Bible, and it's really biting me in the butt, so I'm going to get my Bible. Sorry, guys.
So I mentioned last week that we can kind of use the Ten Commandments as a table of contents for Deuteronomy. And so Last week we started going through chapters 6 and 7, and this week we're starting on 8. But it kind of starts with, if the command is do not take the Lord's name in vain, what we end up getting in Deuteronomy is kind of, beware unless you forget the Lord. And then in chapter 9, which we're going to head into, it's remember the Sabbath is the commandment, and we're going to get remember what God did for you in the wilderness, which is kind of the Sabbath period in Israel's history. Just a couple of notes about chapter 9. It starts out with this statement of, Israel, this is not your doing, this is my doing. It's not because of Israel's righteousness, but because of the Canaanites' wickedness that God has decided that they should not be in the land anymore, that the Israelites should have the land. And then it turns to this kind of history of Israel's rebellion to show them exactly what they did wrong. And it starts out with the tablets. So this is like a mini inclusio. It's not a real one. But you have this step where it starts with the tablets, and then it talks about the golden calf and then how Moses had to intercede on behalf of the people. And then it talks about the other rebellion, complaining about the manna, etc. And Moses has to intercede again. And then you have the replacement tablets kind of ending the section on, you know, here's why you're not good enough, Israel. And it ends in this. It ends in this interesting bit that basically asks, well, what then is required of the people? And the answer is laid out very simply in chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. Fear God, walk in his ways and love him, serve with all your heart and soul, and keep the commandments and statutes. Just a short little list of things that have to be done. And then it proceeds to say, the highest heavens and earth belong to God, but he chose your forefathers, and he chose Israel, and he even chose you. So what do? So circumcise your heart and do not be a stiff-necked people. And this is echoed again in Deuteronomy 30. And it says, God will circumcise the heart to love God with all the heart and soul so that you may live. And so I just wanted to ask, what does it mean to circumcise your heart? We've only had circumcision of, you know, the body so far as the pledge to be God's people. So what does it mean to circumcise the heart?
Is it
something like an expression of full circle? No. Circumcision is a surgical procedure that removes something or binds something. So anyone else have any thoughts? I would suggest simply that what we see in Deuteronomy is maybe that we're moving from we're supposed to obey the laws, but that it's trying to be on a spiritual level, more so than on a physical, everyday, outward living level. Just as Jenna said, this is a more theologically enlightened book, potentially. And maybe we're just starting to move from the outward representation to the inner. I don't know that. It's just one of the thoughts that occurred to me as well. You also have this in chapter 10, verse 17. They use the highest heavens before. You have this language, the heaven of heavens, the God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, mighty, awesome. So we're talking about God here, and we're talking about how good he is, how he is above all the other gods, above all the other powers that could be. He does not show partiality or take bribes. Basically, you can't pay enough or do enough to deserve God's grace. I kind of just thought that was some interesting language in through there. I did not look it up. There are.
The Lord your God is probably Elohim, but I was curious about the God of Gods.
Yeah, I did not look it up.
Not that it matters, I was just curious.
And that brings them, though, with this reminder of who God is and God's choosing of them, that God also executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows love for the alien by giving food and clothing to them. I think implied in this, here at the very end of chapter 10, is you've seen all these things that God has done, how good he is, that he's above everything, and yet he chooses you, and yet he still gives to the orphan and the widow. So I think there's an implicit reminder that you then should treat others as God has treated you. I think that that's implicit in the text.
Yeah, some versions will say a sojourner, you know, so the orphans and the fatherless, fatherless and the widows, and the sojourner, and then 19 says, love the sojourner, therefore, for you are sojourners in the land of Egypt. So it is really a somewhat explicit reminder of, hey, you know, you were brought out of Egypt, and you wandered alone for, you know, alone as a people without a nation for 40 years, yet I was with you and took care of you, so do the same to all these others.
So it is explicit and not implicit.
See, it's a little bit of both.
In my notes, I didn't have that part, so I didn't put it in. So explicit is better than implicit anyway. All right. Deuteronomy 11, I'm just going to say, is about farming. In 11:8, it says, keep the commands so you can go in and possess the land. And then in 11:9, it says, and prolong your days in the land. So I wonder if there's a suggestion here that Israel could lose the land. And I kind of wonder what that says about modern Israel's claim on the Holy Land, is that it was given to their forefathers, right? It was given to Abraham. But is there, here in Deuteronomy 11, is there kind of a threat that, hey, it's not always yours, but it's yours for a time? I'm just curious about that. In 11:10, it talks about Egypt and how the water is flood irrigation. You just put your foot on it and put it into the ground and it'll be fine. But that only considers the Nile area of Egypt. But it compares it to Canaan, where it's a place of hills and valleys, and there will be that you'll have to rely on the rain. And it says, if in verses 13 and 14, essentially, if you obey God, he will send the rain, both the early rain and the late rain. It probably means throughout the season, from like October to April, but it specifically says early rain and late rain. And then it says in verses 16 and 17, essentially, I'm paraphrasing, of course, be faithful or God will shut the heavens. So it's kind of this, it's part of where I guess Job gets its theology, that kind of if you're good, good things will happen. If you're bad, bad things will happen. So it certainly has some basis in the scripture, but I think that we kind of reject that today. Maybe it's because we don't have a land in the promise of rain. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, prosperity gospel, the idea that you do good things and God does good physical things to you, I think does come out of a lot of these portions where you see God promising these sort of things. But if you look at what Jesus says later on, he says that, you know, sunshine comes on the good and the bad, rain comes to the good and the bad. And just a side note, rain and sunshine are not bad things. They're both actually good things to Israel at that time when Jesus says that. Both are considered good things, but yeah, Dave.
He was a storm god. And then it turns from the farmland itself to the other nations. It says, basically, if you keep my commands, I will drive out enemies that are greater than you, the bigger enemies, so the Egyptians and the more powerful nations. And the area that he gives us as the area of Israel is much bigger than we understand it. Basically, from Egypt to Lebanon, the Syrian peninsula, all the way up to the Euphrates. Which this maybe refers to the influence of Israel rather than the actual size of Israel, because we see in Solomon's day, we do have influence from Egypt to Lebanon and from the Syrian peninsula to the Euphrates. So it's just kind of interesting that it's bigger than the land that's been promised to them and that they settled, but it is the area that they end up influence at the height of their power. And then there's also this section at the very end of chapter 11, verses 26 through 29, about blessings and curses. And it basically says, bless Mount Gerizim and curse Mount Ebal. And those are two mountains in Israel to this day, of course. The city, there's a city that lies between them, and it's called Shechem. And by the time of the New Testament, that's Sychar. And it's kind of an implicit, I keep saying implicit this morning. I think that it's trying to drive to a point that the city is built between the mountain of blessing and the mountain of cursing, and they have to decide, are they going to abide by the blessing or abide by the curse? When Jesus is there and talks to the Samaritan woman, she and the others in the community choose the blessing, even at that point in time. So I guess it can beg the question, do we choose the blessing? Is that part of what we do under Jesus? Is we can accept him or we cannot accept him the same way that we had this choice of the mountain of blessing or the mountain of cursing? Just some food for thought. I like to keep going back to this Christological thought. We haven't always been able to do that, but where it fits, I think it fits pretty well here, and I'd like to consider it. We told you in the introduction to Deuteronomy last week that it was kind of split up into three discourses or sermons was one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is you've kind of got this, here's a possible outline of it, right? So you've got the historical prologue that kind of recounts the history of Israel, and then you get into basically the Ten Commandments and expansion of the Ten Commandments, thoughts on the Ten Commandments. And so we're kind of in the heart of that area, and I wanted to bring this outline because it's a little bit different than what we were doing, and I'm kind of following it a little bit more because I find this Ten Commandments as kind of the headings of chapters of Deuteronomy as fairly compelling. And so if we get then into the stipulations area, we've just come now to the start of chapter 12, and I just wanted to show how the Ten Commandments kind of play out in this next section if we go by this new outline of it. You have the commandments are on the right, and then that kind of central column, the warnings about idolatry, laws about worship, is what the content that you find in Deuteronomy. And you can kind of see what they match to. So I just wanted to present that. Deuteronomy 12 is the second inclusio that I wanted to talk about this morning. It starts over in verse 1, actually, with basically, obey the Ten Commandments as long as you're on the earth. And then starting in verse 2, it goes through this inclusio about, and we're talking now about not the first four commandments, really, but we're talking about, well, I guess we still are. We're still in the how to be holy. So I guess we're talking about having no other gods and ceremonial purity. So it focuses in here. The middle of the inclusio is a twofold section, if you will. It's what you cannot eat first and then what you can eat second. And it's, again, with the inclusio, this is the focus of the passage. It's not the other part so much. It's what's in the middle that's the meat of the sandwich, if you will. So I just wanted to show you that. And it actually expands on it, I believe. Or is that in 14? It might be a little bit later. 14 expands on it. So we'll get to that in a minute. Deuteronomy 13 just says, basically, don't be tempted into idolatry by any of these groups of people, by a prophet, by a relative, or by inhabitants of a city. So if it's a prophet, you don't listen to him, and you put him to death. If it's a relative, don't listen to him, put him to death, and in fact, you're supposed to be the first one to cast a stone because it's your relative. And then if it's a city, because it's a big place, comparatively, you're supposed to investigate first and make sure that this person is really saying that, and then put the entire city to ruin and leave it there and never inhabit it again. So I thought that was fairly interesting. All right, Deuteronomy 14 is where it talks about the dietary laws again, and also monetary laws of how to be holy with what you bring into you and with what's around you. So the dietary laws, again, land animals, only animals that have split or divided hooves and chew the cud. Sea animals, fish that have fins and scales are okay. Birds, there's a specific list of forbidden birds, mostly birds that feed on other animals. And then in 14:21, you get the no roadkill rule, that if you find this animal and it's dead, you don't eat it. But you can give it to an alien, or you can sell it to a foreigner. So you don't have to waste it, you just can't eat it yourself.
14 also has a really weird instruction about you're not to boil a goat in its mother's milk. And you can kind of look into this and see that this might have been some sort of pagan practice that they were sort of to stay away from. One of the things that I found was that some of them thought this also just meant like any dairy products were not to be consumed with meat products. So like you could not put butter on your steak, which would have been a big bummer to me. But there were some weird instructions sometimes that you kind of look at and you go, I don't understand this one totally because of our context. Did you find anything?
Well, yeah, there's a big question of whether this is a pagan practice that they're rebelling against or if it's an ethical requirement, and there's a big debate about that. Also, at the beginning of chapter 14, there's this command not to cut yourself because someone has died in grief, because that's what pagans do. So again, is that really a pagan practice, or is it a larger ethical point against, about harming yourself? So there are debates about those, both at the beginning of the chapter and kind of in the middle of the chapter with the dietary laws. And then it turns from the dietary laws to the monetary laws, which is basically saying, be holy in how you spend your money. It starts in verse 22 with the tithe, meaning specifically the tenth. That's the word used there. In verse 23, you're supposed to take the tithe and have it as a meal before the Lord. In the place that he appoints. If that is too far, if it would spoil before you get there, then you're supposed to sell it and take the money and go spend it on whatever you want. And then go take that before to the place that's been appointed and basically have a party there. And it's a very inclusive party because you're not supposed to forget the Levite when you do this. So the Levite doesn't have anything, so make sure you take enough stuff enough with you to provide for the Levite. And then every third year, you're supposed to take the tithe to the town, and instead of you having the party, the Levite, the alien, the orphan, and the widow are supposed to enjoy it. So that's kind of an interesting... we always talk about the Jubilee year, and we talk about every seventh year slaves going free, which we'll get to in a little bit, but this was in every third year so that orphans and widows are celebrated. And chapter 15 actually kind of continues on this and gets into the every 7 years, that basically there's a remission of debts every 7 years. The creditor is to release any loan that he's given to his neighbor. In verse 3, you're still allowed to charge foreigners, just we're really talking about loans that you've given to other Hebrews, other Israelites. And then it says in verses 4 and 5, chapter 15, verses 4 and 5, there will be no poor among you if you listen to the Lord and obey his commandments. Which begs the question, I suppose, why did Jesus say you will always have the poor with you? He knows his Deuteronomy, obviously, since he keeps citing to it. So it's kind of interesting. And I kind of think that what we're getting at here is that the key to poverty is in the pocket of your neighbor, if that makes sense. In Ephesians 4:28, for instance, it says, steal no longer, but instead work so you have something to share with others. So the purpose of having money is to share it with others. So if I have no money, someone else is theoretically working so that I am not poor, and then when situations reverse and I am working and they have no money, I am working so that they have something. So there's this charitable circle, this charitable requirement that that I think we overlook sometimes.
Yeah, and this isn't the only portion of Deuteronomy where it basically says, if you're going to loan to one another, don't charge any interest, don't hold it against them. Like, you loan them the money and then they pay you back the money. There's nothing more than that. This doesn't need to be, don't take advantage of one another.
Yeah. And even with this loaning, in verses 7 and 8, 15, 7 and 8, says, basically, if you're coming up on this seventh year when everything is supposed to be forgiven, and there's a poor person, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand, but lend generously still. It doesn't matter that you're not going to get paid back. I mean, this is a requirement to... It essentially says it's not about you, it's about the poor person, which is very interesting to me. The specific word in verse 9, it says, basically, the year of remission shall not influence your generosity. And the actual term for generosity that it's using there is basically the evil eye. And so in Proverbs, we see it also say, he who is generous will be blessed, for he gives some of his food to the poor. And the word there for generous is the one with the good eye, rather than... So there's a little bit of interpretive translation going there, but you have the evil eye and the good eye. And that's also echoed, I think, into Matthew with Jesus saying, the eye is the lamp of the body. So then if your eye is clear, or the good eye, your whole body will be full of light. If your eye is bad, that's his actual word, the evil eye, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? So I think it's interesting that Jesus kind of quotes this same idea anyway with the good and evil eye. We're also supposed to give generously. You shall not be grieved when you give. You shouldn't feel burdened by it. You should be doing it happily. Okay. All right. In 15:11, it says again that the poor will never cease to be in the land, even though we've just been told that there will be no poor in the land. I've not heard that translation, but that doesn't invalidate it. That just means that the translations that I've looked at don't say it that way.
Well, the portion we were looking at was 11, verse 11, for the poor, for there will never cease to be poor in the land. So it was actually a different portion of Deuteronomy. Yeah, I was just saying that they were talking about different verses. Yeah. That's why they're talking about different things.
which translation is that, just out of curiosity? KJV, okay. Okay. I didn't look at the KJV, so it makes some sense. It also makes sense here, looking at the later one, when it says there will always be poor. So maybe not. I'll leave it at that because I'm not trying to put down the KJV. It's just a 400-year-old translation, give or take, as opposed to some of the newer translations that have better access to Hebrew sources. I don't know that makes it any better or worse, just saying the way that it's translated changes over time depending on sources available. So... it could be, it could not be. I don't know. Some manuscripts weren't discovered until the 1800s, and so they may use those instead. Things like that. Not to put down the KJV. I will just say this about the KJV. It should actually be all of the James that appear in it are actually Jacob's. We use James now because the translators wanted to honor the king at the time. They said, oh, well, no one will know if we change a Jacob for a James.
The king wanted to honor himself.
Well, just a little fact about it. I think that one's fun. But anyway, so that's why we use James as the name more often than Jacob. All right. into chapter 15. Again, it stresses, let's see, we ended it in 15:11 there. Mm-hmm. You'll always have the poor. Oh, that's right. It says the poor will never cease to be in the land. And then again in Matthew, turning to the words of Jesus, it's kind of interesting that he says, you will always have the poor, but you will not always have me. So he kind of echoes the same thought from Deuteronomy that the poor are always going to be around. Anyway, in 15:12, it turns the topic to slavery. So if a Hebrew is sold to you, after that person has served you for 6 years, you're supposed to set them free at the beginning of the seventh year. In fact, you're not just supposed to set that person free. You're supposed to give him or her sheep or grain and wine and bless him or her as God has blessed you. You're supposed to always remember that, as God has blessed you. In 16 and 17, in fact, if the slave does not want to leave because you've treated that person rightly during their time with you, then it says pierce the ear. You're supposed to make them part of the family. You're supposed to incorporate them into the larger family and not treat them as a slave anymore. And again, this is all from, it says in 15:15, remember how I have redeemed you from Egypt. Remember how the Egyptians gave you stuff when you left Egypt, is basically what he's saying. I redeemed you that way, and so you should redeem people the same way. I was going to just quickly go over 16 here. These are the special feast days that are laid out in chapter 16, the three major festivals. They're all supposed to be done at the place where God appointed, which I remember talking about last week was a major theme of this. Basically, that meant the town of Shiloh until the Jerusalem temple was built. Passover lasted for 7 days. The Feast of Weeks started on the 50th day after. It was 7 weeks after Passover ended, and then you're supposed to start on the first day of that new week after 7 weeks had passed. So that means that's Pentecost, for those of you who are kind of going, what is Pentecost and where did it come from? Why did the Spirit come at that point? It's another festival in Jerusalem. Jesus dies at Passover, and about 50 days later, we have Pentecost. So I just thought that was interesting that it's there. The emphasis, interestingly enough, on Pentecost is that it's supposed to be about the whole family, about the servants, about the Levites, the strangers, the orphans, the widows. It's supposed to be all-inclusive, that you're supposed to be throwing this big party for all of them. So, and then I just wanted to, that kind of ends this one section of the ceremonial righteousness, so I just wanted to pull up that it kind of then turns to governmental righteousness. It talks about qualifications of leaders and such coming up. So it talks about judges and witnesses in the second part of chapter 16 and into 17, and what the king is supposed to do. Even though there's no king and there's been no mention of a king, it still has, when you come into the land and you're going to ask for a king, I'm going to appoint that king, and then here are some things that king is supposed to do. So first off, judges and officers are supposed to be appointed. They are not to distort justice. They are not to be partial. They are not to take bribes. It says, you shall pursue only justice so you may live and possess the land. It specifically says, no Asherah trees nor sacred pillars, because theoretically those were things that would take you away from true justice. It says, no sacrifices of any kind to anyone else, no idolatry in the judges or officers. Oh, no, that turns to everyone. It says, basically, the people are not to commit idolatry. If someone worships something other than God, then you shall investigate. The officers, the judges should investigate, and then stone that man or woman to death. However, to impose the death penalty in verse 6, you must have multiple witnesses to put that person to death. One witness was insufficient for this cause. The witnesses, in fact, were to be the ones to cast the first stones before the rest of the community. We have the same context then, I guess, with Jesus talking about with the woman caught in adultery, and he says, well, who's going to cast the first stone? Who's going to be the first witness to do this? And none of them are willing to do it. It just kind of adds an extra dimension to that, because one, everyone realizes their own sin, And two, maybe there's no actual witness to this, that it may be, in fact, trumped up. Just another thought on that. Then it turns to, if the case is too difficult to decide, then you're supposed to go to the tabernacle or the temple to the priest and let the priest decide the case rather than the judge himself. And then it turns in 17:14 to, when you decide you want a king, the Lord will decide who it is. The king shall not multiply his horses or his wives or his gold or his silver or ever return the people to Egypt, but shall trust in the Lord. The idea is that the king is not supposed to be looking after his own military power, his own might, his own wealth, that those things are all supposed to come from the Lord, and he's not supposed to worry about it. It says in 17:18 specifically that the king shall write himself a copy of this law in the presence of the priests. The king had to know this law backwards and forwards, and the priests were there to make sure he didn't cheat. He actually did this and actually learned it. And then in 19 and 20, the king was supposed to keep the law with him and study it every day. And I think this is all very interesting, too, in the larger Deuteronomistic history. When we're talking about King Josiah finding the scroll, somewhere along the way they stopped doing this. If it was ever done before, I don't know if anyone actually ever did it. But it says here in the law, he's supposed to be doing this. He's supposed to be memorizing this. So there's that. Deuteronomy 18 has laws for Levites, laws against pagan worship, and laws about prophets. In 18:15, I'm just going to look at the prophets real quick. It says, there will be a prophet like Moses, and you shall listen to him. So I guess the question is, what does it mean to be a prophet like Moses? It is a good question. I'm going to suggest, and I don't know that this is right, this is just what I came up with, that Moses stood before God on behalf of the people. The other prophets don't do that. The other prophets carry Moses' word, not Moses' word, God's word. So, you know, Jeremiah speaks the truth, and those things come to pass, which it says in 18:21 and 22, the test of prophecy is basically this. When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, it comes true. If it doesn't come true, that person's not a real prophet. But Moses is different in that he stands before God on behalf of the people. He continues to intercede, as we saw recounted in that history. And so I wonder if that's what they're driving at. I don't know what it means that there will be a prophet like Moses.
I also think that, well, if we look at this kind of the way that we might be, which is, you know, the prophet like Moses being Jesus, I think about Peter when Jesus asked him, you know, who do you say that I am? And Peter said, well, some say that you're Moses, you know, some say you're Elijah. And then I also look at the fact that both of them led Israel out of captivity, of course, you know, Jesus in a much more metaphorical way, but led the people from captivity and into the promised land. And so I think there are some parallels that aren't there, but I think you could also maybe draw parallels to John the Baptist if you tried to.
Yeah. This is one of the earliest messianic statements of any type. It doesn't promise a savior, but it promises some figure will be coming that you should be looking for. I thought that was interesting. I ran out of time to do slides, so we'll just continue on. Chapter 19 is about killings, basically. We talked about the cities of refuge before that were set up, that there would be six cities of refuge. It ends up that there are three on each bank of the Jordan. And that if you accidentally killed someone, you could run to that city of refuge. So that this goes through a section of what those accidental killings are. That's in 19:4 through 10. And it then compares those to intentional killings in 11 through 13, and those require the death penalty. There is no stepping around that. You can't get away from that. And then it talks about boundaries in 19:14. Moving boundaries is tantamount to stealing, but it kind of implies the boundaries of these cities of refuge as well. Before it then moves on to if we're stealing people's lives, basically, in the cities of refuge by moving their boundaries, well, look at what witnesses can do as well. It's kind of how it transitions into the second part of the chapter. Basically, again, it requires 2 to 3 witnesses, not just one. And then malicious witnesses, those who are bringing false allegations. If there's any suspicion that they are false allegations, they're supposed to go to the priest with the accused person, and the priest should then investigate. And then if the punishment being asked for by the witness, they're supposed to visit, put that punishment onto the witness if it's a false allegation. So this is where we come up in the Old Testament with, it says in verse 21, you shall not show pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. But it only refers to false witnesses. So I think that's a really important distinction, because we have the lex talionis, that's what it's called, the eye for an eye. We see that all over the Middle East, and that's the general law, but it is only biblically for false witnesses. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I would say, how does this relate to turn the other cheek? And I would say that one is a governmental, one is personal. You can only forgive, for instance, on your own behalf. You can't forgive on someone else's behalf. So if I said to, you know, if James had wronged Mitchell, I couldn't say, James, it's okay, you don't have to worry about Mitchell, we're good. Only Mitchell can forgive James. So, right, yeah.
Which is why I think when you look at Jesus, it's somewhat controversial when he talks about forgiving sins, like, because that was, there were sins against one another, but there were also sins against God, and Jesus often was forgiving sins that the Jewish community thought were sins against God, and this was, you know, they would know this, and so you would go back to this concept that, okay, well, you can't forgive sins on behalf of God, and yet you are. Yeah. You know, that's why Jesus asks what's harder, forgive sins or to tell somebody get up and walk, and also, you know, why you went to the cross and other things like that. But there's just a parallel there that I saw too.
Yeah. And then I'll just turn to chapters 20 and 21 just in a sentence each. They're about the military and about further killings. Basically, if a body is found out in the middle of nowhere, who's responsible for that is what chapter 21 is about. And chapter 20 is about military exemptions and terms of peace given to people, except in the promised land, which there are no terms of peace. Those people are under God's condemnation, and so they're not to be forgiven. So
that's it. Next week we'll get into a little bit more laws on slavery and a bunch of other things.
All right. We'll try to finish out Deuteronomy next week, 22 through 34. So thank you all very much.